This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the BBC Music Magazine for February of 2022, we get a behind-the-scenes look at composer Ludovico Einaudi. His fans may run into the millions, but the pianist and composer tells Claire Jackson, his style of writing will always struggle to find total acceptance within the classical musical world. Ludovico Einaudi has a special manuscript displayed in his studio. It's a student piece of his with corrections from a surprising mentor, Karlheinz Stockhausen. When the renowned avant-gardist came to Milan during the early 1980s, the young Einaudi was a keen attendee at his lectures. "It was a very important experience for me," says the Italian pianist and composer, smiling at my surprised expression. At the time, Stockhausen was writing Licht. His seven opera series, Donnerstag, Samstag, and Montag, were premiered at La Scala, which uses the idea of composing to a formula. "I loved the idea that a week of music could be contained in a single seed. It's something that has stayed with me. Of course, my language is very different to Stockhausen." Different is a wry understatement. Stockhausen's electronic and aleatoric works are considered among contemporary music's most advanced achievements, but not, as one editor has said to me, the sort of thing one hums after the concert. Einaudi, on the other hand, specializes in hummable melodies. According to the official charts, his music is currently streamed over a million times a day, played everywhere from arena concerts to yoga classes. Should you ever see a Play Me, I'm Yours piano at a shopping center, someone at some point is sure to sit down and tap out a little Einaudi. But Einaudi's greatest achievement is the repopularization of the celebrity pianist-composer, developing the legacy left by Liszt. Whereas the Hungarian virtuoso pushed the newly invented piano to its limits, the strings are more likely to remain intact after an Einaudi concert. But while the Italian takes a much softer, less technically demanding approach, his music appears just as impactful on its audience. The poet Heinrich Heine described the frenzied behavior at a Liszt concert as listomania. And according to biographer Oliver Helms, women tore at each other's hair in trying to lay hands on a glass or a handkerchief that Liszt used. In 2014, after Einaudi's In a Time-Lapse concert at the 11,000-capacity Arena di Verona, I witnessed a 21st-century equivalent. As Einaudi signed a group of breathless teenager scores, one girl proffered her arm and insisted the composer inked it. After a moment's hesitation, he obliged. "I will get tattoo," the young woman assured me. I remind Einaudi about this incident, wondering whether it was unusual. "I have met several people who have my notes tattooed on them," he comments, apparently both pleased and mildly embarrassed. The music's accessibility means that Einaudi's fans aren't just listeners. They are often players as well. Scores are as highly anticipated as the album release. It's a model that has gone on to inspire dozens of others. Yeruma, Stefan Mocho, and Joip Beving, to name a few, sells sheet music alongside records, supported by concerts of their own pieces. "I am now one in a forest of pianists who work this way," agrees Ionaudi. "It was an interesting time when I first started, as there were still music shops and they didn't know where to place my music. Is it classical or pop?" There may be fewer music shops today, but labeling Ionaudi's music remains as contentious as it was 20 years ago. "Of course, there are lots of people who don't like my music, and I respect their opinion," he says politely. "But some people put on the internet that I pretend to write classical music. What does that mean?" American composer Nico Muhly is similarly baffled by the industry's insistence on categorization. Reviewers and previewers get an enormous pass if they can describe a composer's work as being part of some sort of genre: post-minimalist, new complexity, Darmstadt school, chamber pop, whatever. Or this new hellery, indie classical, writes Muhly. And woe betide any composer, be it Muhly, Anna Meredith, or Ionaudi, who moves between those brackets. The problem is compounded when the artist is commercially successful. To millions of fans, Ionaudi is currently the world's greatest pianist-composer. To most classical music critics, he is not. Ionaudi was introduced to the piano by his mother, an accomplished musician. "My grandfather, her father, was a conductor and composer. She was not professional, but she taught me about Bach, Chopin, and Schubert, and the Rolling Stones." His paternal grandfather was Luigi Ionaudi, the second president of Italy, and his father was a notable publisher. The varied cultural diet had a big impact on the teenage Ionaudi. "I loved rock music, folk, and classical. I honestly couldn't choose between these types of music, as they all gave me something. I couldn't say I love Chopin, so I will throw away the Beatles." After graduating from Milan's conservatory, he continued studying composition with Luciano Berio and was awarded a scholarship to the Tanglewood Music Festival. "When I started to make my own music, I wanted to bring all these influences into one career," he reflects. "I composed piano ballades that were in the tradition of classical composers, songs without words, but that used harmony from the rock-pop tradition. It wasn't a precise plan, and I didn't know what would happen. I just played what I felt was right." The result was Ionaudi's first solo album, Le Onde, or The Waves, in 1996, inspired by Virginia Woolf's novel of the same name. Both this and I Giorni, or The Days, from 2001, benefited from airtime on Classic FM, and at a time before streaming, Ionaudi's music became some of the most frequently requested. In 2011, Radio 1 DJ Greg James described how he revised at university while listening to Ionaudi and began playing the piano music on the show as part of the station's support for students. The title track from I Giorni was subsequently downloaded so many times that it entered the official singles chart top 40. And the pianist was invited to perform in a special Radio 1 piano session. Ionaudi has continued to break new ground. In a time lapse, 2013 became the first classical release to sell more digital downloads than physical copies. With the exception of Elton John, no other pianist is capable of selling out multiple dates for large venues on the same scale. The cover of Ionaudi's latest album, Underwater, features a swan photographed by the composer himself. He increasingly turns to nature for inspiration. The more I live, the more interested I am in having a relationship with nature rather than human beings, he says, only half-jokingly. The 12 pieces on Underwater are all for solo piano, which has been prepared by adding additional felt to the hammers. I was looking for a specific color. It was a long process, he says. Like so many recent projects, Underwater was impacted by the 2020 lockdowns. The first entirely solo album Ionauti has released in 20 years, it was written during a period of extended isolation and has an improvisatory style. I wrote every day and began to edit and refine sections as you would, he says. But I found that I was not adding to the music. The best pieces were musical breaths. Once I'd exhaled, it was done. Underwater follows on from Cinema, a compilation of Ionauti's greatest screenwriting hits. To date, he has written for 80 film and TV projects, including The Intouchables, Nomadland, and The Water Diviner. He is also the unlikely creative behind the soundtrack to This Is England, a gritty, powerful British film and subsequent TV spin-off about skinheads and white supremacist culture in the 1980s. In between snippets of The Specials and The Smiths are dark piano melodies that perfectly track the on-screen trauma. It's bleakness that goes beyond the comfortable tunes in, say, Nightbook or 7 Days Walking, and reveals another side to the composer. What Ionauti's music means to so many listeners may be gathered through a glance at YouTube comments. He has over 1 million subscribers on his official YouTube channel. As someone who suffers from mental health issues, I find this music so helpful, says one writer. This music literally saved my life, notes another. Ludovico is the pianist who made me start piano lessons at 44, adds someone else, while a jovial commentator puts, how many people came here as they need to knock out an essay? That last one attracted over 2,000 likes. It might not be the most harmonically adventurous or technically complex, but Ionauti's pianism heals, soothes, engages, and encourages. It comforts hectic minds and brings peace. There's an anxiety about having to be busy, even if there's no reason for it, he says. My music is a manifesto for slowing down. In the April 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Brian Wise brings us a little history of the encore. Sometimes an encore outshines the concert preceding it. Such was the case at a recital last October in Parma, Italy, when the soprano Lisette Oropesa decided to add a fourth unrehearsed encore to her program. A problem loomed. The selection Sempre Libera from Verdi's La Traviata requires a tenor, which had not been arranged. Sensing the impending void, Liu Zhongwei, a music student from a nearby conservatory, rose from his seat in the auditorium and belted out the offstage tenor part to the apparent delight of Oropesa and the audience. Audience video captured the moment, and clips soon ricocheted across social media, YouTube, and TikTok. Liu later met Oropesa backstage and offered what turned out to be an unnecessary apology. The French word encore, meaning literally again, first appeared in English in the early 18th century, used by audiences of Italian opera in London. It was simply the repetition of a selection, aria, overture, that had garnered enough applause to be performed again. But over time, some encores have risen to sensational status on their own. Consider one that pianist Rudolf Serkin gave in Berlin in 1921. The formal program had ended with a crowd-pleasing rendition of Bach's Fifth Brandenburg Concerto, complete with a blazing cadenza. Backstage, violinist Adolf Busch urged Serkin to perform an encore. "What shall I play?" the 18-year-old Serkin asked. "The Goldberg Variations," Busch replied jokingly. The pianist took him at his word and delivered Bach's entire work. Serkin later recalled that the only remaining audience members were Busch and his wife, the pianist Arthur Schnabel, and the musicologist Alfred Einstein. A very different element of surprise colored the encores given in 1951 by Renata Tabaldi during a joint recital with Maria Callas in Rio de Janeiro. The sopranos had agreed that neither would upstage the other by performing encores. But Tabaldi gave not one, but two. As the story goes, Callas later berated Tabaldi publicly at a dinner party, referencing a recent flop in Italy and setting off a long-standing rivalry. 18th and early 19th century encores grew out of a more freewheeling era for concert etiquette. When audiences called for one at the premiere of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, the Allegretto received a second hearing, but mid-show encores posed a larger test for opera houses. As Theodor Fenner details in Opera in London, impresarios and critics found them vulgar and intrusive, but also a statistical gauge of public taste. As a Times reviewer noted in 1791, "John Bull will perhaps think it extraordinary that during the evening there did not occur one encore." Encore practice was more tightly controlled in royal theaters, where only a monarch or his deputy could demand one. When Cimarosa's comedy Il Matrimonio Segreto was staged in Vienna before the Holy Roman Emperor Leopold II, the monarch was so pleased that he ordered dinner for the cast and then called for a repeat of the nearly three-hour opera, possibly the longest encore in history. In early 19th century Paris, professional claques known as biseuses were hired to hype singers by calling out for encores. Almost everyone understood their role, and prima donnas who denied audiences encores did so at their peril. When German soprano Gertrud Elisabeth Mara refused to sing one in a 1785 performance at King's Theater, the audience angrily hissed. A Times reviewer took her side, arguing that the airs should not be bravoed till the symphony be closed. But when Mara refused again in 1793, the Times this time decided she was very properly hissed for refusing. More often, divas embraced show-stopping moments. During a Metropolitan Opera touring production of Gounod's Roméo et Juliette in Boston in 1895, an upright piano was wheeled onto the stage so that soprano Nellie Melba could sing her encore. When soprano Marcella Sembrich was called back for multiple encores during Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor in Washington, D.C., even the musicians dropped their instruments, stood up in their seats, and cried, "Bravo!" reported the Washington Evening Star. By the 1910s, conductors including Arturo Toscanini had seen enough and refused to grant singers their starry moment, thus marking a decline in the practice. The Met drew a line with a chaotic 1924 production of Flotow's Martha, as the audience called on tenor Beniamino Gigli to repeat the aria Ma Pari. Conductor Gennaro Papi pressed ahead with the next scene, even as Gigli was still returning for more bows. The words, "Positively no encores allowed," began appearing in capital letters in programs. Both Milan's La Scala and the Met finally relaxed their encore policies in 2007 and 2008, respectively, when tenor Juan Diego Flores was invited to repeat the high C-laden tenor aria from Donizetti's La Fille du Raisonnement. An earlier thought, the Met, came in 1994 when Luciano Pavarotti repeated an aria in Tosca. These moments drew both excitement and some renewed tutting. In lifting official prohibitions and traditional restraints, hasn't the Met let a monster out of the bottle? Asked Newsday theater critic Linda Weiner. If tonight's audience gets an encore, won't tomorrow's feel cheated if they just get a fine performance? Without the encores, does it mean that the other guy saw a better show? Encores are usually plotted carefully and repeated over the course of a performance run or tour. In an era of strict contracts, union rules, and licensing restrictions, venues are actively involved in encore preparation to ensure a smooth and timely finish. Yet, among pianists, encore policies vary. Arthur Schnabel detested them, while Evgeny Kisin dispensed 12 encores at the 2007 Carnegie Hall recital. Sergei Rachmaninoff would always signal that he was done for the night by playing his prelude in C-sharp minor. "A new composition by myself," he said, in a sarcastically theatrical voice, before one Philadelphia performance, suggesting that he had grown weary of the ritual. At Carnegie Hall in 1918, Rachmaninoff disappointed the flappers in the balconies by denying them the prelude. "All of flapperdom sorrowed last night," snorted the New York Times' James Gibbons Huneker, "for there are amiable fanatics who follow this pianist from place to place, hoping to hear him in this particular prelude, like the Englishman who attended every performance of the Lady Lion Tamer, hoping to see her swallowed by one of her pets." Some of history's most attention-getting encores have doubled as social or political statements. Daniel Barenboim and the Berlin Staatskapelle used the humble encore in 2001 as a way to introduce the prelude to Tristan and Isolde to Israel, breaking with the country's unofficial Wagner ban and setting off a tempest, with some audience members shouting epithets and walking out. Other performers have displayed a more relaxed side through their encores. Pianist Gabriela Montero, known for her improvisation skills, has improvised encores based on themes requested or sung by audience members. Violinist Pekka Kuusisto has played and sang jaunty Finnish folk songs, even leading an audience sing-along at the BBC Proms in 2016. And fellow fiddler Hilary Hahn, tired of trotting out familiar pieces, commissioned short encores for violin and piano from 26 composers, then held an online competition to choose a 27th. Perhaps as more artists rethink performance conventions in this unsettled era, the spontaneity of a well-executed encore can make its way into the formal part of programs. Then again, there's the old show business maxim, always leave audiences wanting more. We asked two of today's performing soloists how they handle encores. First, Johannes Moser, cellist. These days I tend to play an encore with the whole cello section after a concerto, such as Pablo Casals' Song of the Birds, or the second movement of Grieg's Holberg Suite, arranged for six cellos. Often a concerto is more like a symphony with a solo part, so rather than pushing the rest of the orchestra aside in the encore, it's nice to be more inclusive. Encore choices may have changed in recent years as the role of the soloist is changing. There's no longer that singular star cult. Instead, the soloist is a kind of ambassador between the orchestra and the public. The encore becomes an opportunity to make a statement about how you view your role in that context. Henning Kragerud, violinist. Once during a tour, I realized that I had forgotten to prepare an encore, so I decided instead to trust in my ability to improvise a straight from the heart. It worked out so well that I often now improvise as an introduction to the main pieces in my concert programs. I take the harmonic progression from the central work, or any other appropriate elements, and improvise over them. In this way, I'm not just performing the work of the composer, I'm a co-creator. Our reverence for classical repertoire can sometimes feel a bit like a religion, because encores form a less regulated part of the concert. They present the opportunity for greater creativity. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.